joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Famed investor Warren Buffett once said, "It's only when the tide goes out that you discover who's been swimming naked." Now that the Greek debt crisis has taken center stage, and as other EU nations disclose similar stark financial balance sheets, analysts and investors fear Greece may not be the only country caught cooking its books. Joining me in the studio to talk about what's happening in Greece, the European Union, and its effect on the U.S. and global economies, Sebastian Mallaby with the Council on Foreign Relations, and Lionel Barber. He's editor of the Financial Times. Also joining us this morning from his office at the Peterson Institute for International Economics here in Washington is Simon Johnson. You can join us as well. Call 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Morning, Diane.
Good morning.
And are you there, Simon Johnson?
Yes, I am.
Good morning to you. Lionel Barber, it's good to see you again.
Very nice to be back, Diane.
You go way, way back on this program. How are the markets behaving in Europe today?
Well, actually, markets are up only slightly. Talk a bit about an improving American economy. So that kind of goes against sentiment. I wouldn't necessarily take that to be a long-term trend.
Sebastian, explain to us what's happened in Greece and why it has disrupted the EU.
Well, I think the first thing to do in a show like this is to agree that we shouldn't use too many analogies with Greek gods, because they've been rather overworked. I think the only good one actually was when people contemplating the Armageddon that's coming said Acropolis now. But apart from that, I promise not to talk about Pluto's shield and so forth. What's happening is simply that the Greeks borrowed way too much, spent way too much, owe way too much, and lied about it. And so when they suddenly announced that the forecast public budget deficit, which was forecast at sort of 3.7% of GDP in 2009, came in at 12.7. That huge shock naturally scared the people who had lent money to Greece, the bond holders, and suddenly the bond market started to behave very worryingly. And people realized that in April coming up, Greece has to issue a whole bunch of new debt, refinance some of the old debt, and who's going to lend to them? I mean, they've just spent too much and they've been dishonest about it.
So, Simon Johnson, does this mean that Greece, through its inaction, or perhaps, as Sebastian has put it, simply lying about its economy, has brought the entire EU to the brink of financial meltdown?
Yes, but I would like to say a word on behalf of the bond market, in the sense that while Sebastian's correct that the Greeks have overborrowed and they've misrepresented much of what they've done, they were not just encouraged by various big players in the bond market, they were actually brought into deals that allowed this to happen. And there's a great question now whether the European Union knew at the beginning of this process when the euro was formed, so 2001-2002, critical phase when Greece was allowed in, a lot of people had concerns about their fiscal policy, about their budget deficit going forward. They were given, a pretty generous read by the officials in Brussels. Who knew what kind of state Greece was really in, what was revealed to whom and on what basis? That's a great question right now.
So EU complicity, Lion?
Well, I might be able to help throw some light on this murky affair because I happen to be in Brussels as a correspondent for the Financial Times in 1998. I was there for the previous 6 years, from crisis to creation, because there was, if you remember, in 1992, 93, the monetary union seemed as though it was going to not happen because of tremendous moves in the currency markets. And the intermediate stage, the European Exchange Rate Mechanism, collapsed. Now, fast forward to 1998-9. The fact is, Simon is correct. People did turn a blind eye. They knew that countries, particularly Greece, big questions about Italy, that they were massaging, if you like, the figures. But the sense was, one, that they were going in the right direction in terms of reducing their debts and deficits, and two, that the Germans, who had tremendous concerns about letting in what we loosely call the Club Med countries, were not that it wasn't going to be sustainable. But these political objections were overcome, Chancellor Kohl agreed, and monetary union went ahead with Club Med on board.
Sebastian.
On this point, actually, it's interesting that in Lionel's paper, The Financial Times, there was an op-ed published, I think, in 2001, which I happened to read over the weekend, because a hedge fund manager emailed it to me and said, you should really take a look at this. And the op-ed said, published in 2001, here is how Italy has been massaging its accounts using fancy currency swaps that disguise the real extent of its debt. So, in fact, there was some knowledge, I think, ahead of time about the nature of this dissembling. But, and in fact, the European Statistical Agency, Eurostat, started in 2004 to clamp down on some of these off-balance sheet Enron-type accounting tricks. So it was known to some extent, and I think the argument that one is starting to hear, and perhaps Simon will disagree with me here, but I think the argument that this is Wall Street's fault, that investment banks have peddled these tricks to governments that somehow had no choice but to say, yes, sure, we'll do the trick, that's ridiculous.
Simon.
Yes, I do disagree, actually, on that point. I am not saying that this is all Wall Street's responsibility. Of course not. But there's a very interesting parallel here to what we've seen in this country with subprime mortgages and all these other dubious products. Of course, there's someone who borrows, and you can blame the you can always blame the borrower if you want. But there's also a market comprised of very big players such as Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase and others, and the European banks too. This is not a particularly American. It is a U.S. and European set of operatives. And these people tell you that this is a great deal. They tell you that this is legal. They tell you that I'm talking about subprime, and I'm also talking about dubious currency swaps in the Greek case. And I think there is a level of responsibility here. I mean, remember, this is very important. We saved these big banks in 2008, 2009 in the interest of global financial stability. To then find out that they've turned around, and as recently as last November, according to the New York Times, Goldman Sachs was pitching Greece on more dubious debt deals. If that story is true, maybe Lionel has a perspective on that, that's really bad. We save these banks in order to stabilize the world, and we find they're going around trying to destabilize the world. That just doesn't make any sense.
Well, I'm going to side somewhat with Sebastian here. I think we can shoot the banks and the bankers for a number of misdeeds, but the idea that these governments didn't know what they were doing or what they were buying.
Somebody had to know.
This is the St. Augustine problem that, you know, oh, Lord, make me virtuous, but not just yet. I'll pay my debts back, but not just yet. And this was what was happening. And by the way, the Goldman deals, while interesting, they're important, but they're not as significant, in my view, as other deals, particularly with Italy, involving other banks.
The
scale of the problem is much bigger.
Hold on. Here's a message on Facebook from Chuck. He says, my concern is whether some of the other deeply indebted European countries, Italy, Portugal, Spain, are substantially underreporting the true amount of their liabilities, as Greece has done. And then goes on to say, I wouldn't be surprised if it's revealed that Goldman Sachs and others created massive, ill-advised derivatives for other countries.
Well, before we enter that particular question, the crucial point about Greece is that they've got a double whammy. They've got a huge deficit and huge amounts of debt. If you look at Spain or you look at Italy, they don't. They've got one or the other. They've got high deficits but lowish debt.
They don't have both. All
yeah.
Right.
Or Italy's got huge amounts of debt, but less high deficit. The problem with Greece is it's the double.
Both.
Yeah.
The other thing is if you bring in the private sector into the equation, and you look at the kind of total Greek economy, their current account deficit last year in other words, the sort of trade deficit plus a few other small things, was 12-point-something% of GDP. I mean, absolutely off the scale. To give you an idea, that's double the size of Spain's deficit, and it's four times as big as the US deficit, which people worry about as well. So Greece was off the charts in terms of a lack of national savings as well.
Simon.
But I would stress this issue about disclosure and about knowledge, which is the point that Chuck was making. Do we know how much debt these countries have? Do we really know? And perhaps we do. Perhaps Eurostat has a handle on this. But I think, Lionel, you'll agree. Let me put it this way. Bloomberg has a story this morning, a very well-researched story, that establishes that the Goldman, just as an example, I'm not particularly singling out Goldman. I think others were doing similar things in other places, perhaps. But Goldman did not disclose to investors, people who bought the Greek government debt, that they helped sell quite a lot of this, $20 or $30 billion. Goldman did not disclose that they had also arranged these currency swaps that had the net effect of making Greece's numbers look better. So there was a non-disclosure of material adverse information. If I were an investor, if I'd bought those bonds, I would be pretty upset. And if those bonds default, I can pretty much assure you there's going to be a class action lawsuit over this.
Yeah, I'd need to look at the story, Simon, but from what you're saying, yes, there's legitimate reason for concern. You'd also, I do believe that there was a lot of available evidence at Eurostat because, as Sebastian says, they're cleaning up their act.
The other thing is that no doubt there are problems with the conduct of Goldman Sachs, of course, but at the same time, it's instructive to remember that today the statisticians who work in the Greek finance ministry who are supposed to be monitoring this, they are on strike.
Sebastian Malaby, Lionel Barber, Simon Johnson, three extraordinarily knowledgeable people. Short break, right back. And as we talk about the situation with Greece, the rest of the EU, we have with us three guests. Sebastian Malaby, he's director of the Morris Greenberg Center for Geoeconomic Studies. He's at the Council on Foreign Relations. Simon Johnson is at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Lionel Barber is editor of the Financial Times. We have many questions and callers. A lot of people want to know, what is stopping Germany from stepping in to save Greece? Sebastian.
Well, this is all part of a very long tradition of Germany's ambivalence towards sort of the other European players. Back in 1992, as Lionel alluded to, there was this extraordinary breakup of the European exchange rate mechanism of the time. And the political debate there was, what would Germany put first? Its commitment to sound money, which meant high interest rates, or its desire to keep European integration on track, which would have meant lower interest rates to help the Italians and the British at the time stay in this combined currency union. And the Germans at the time chose high interest rates and hard money, and it drove the markets to push both Italy and then later Britain out of the European exchange rate mechanism. So that was the choice they made in 92. Now, Germany is faced with a similar political debate. You know, how much does it stick and insist to fiscal prudence, to managing your budget properly? How much does it sort of defer to the German public sense that when they work on average to 67 in Germany and the Greeks work on average to 57 and then they retire, why should the Germans subsidize this early Greeks retirement? It's politically toxic in Germany to say that you support bailing out the Greeks. On the other hand, if Germany cares about European integration and European institutions, then it needs to support a bailout. That's the debate.
What's the most important word in the German language? Stabilität, stability. And that means, as Sebastian's saying, hard money, keeping your house in order. And the view of the German public was these reckless Southern Europeans, when we shouldn't be bailing them out. Now, just again, it's interesting to look at history. The deal in 1989, after the collapse of the Berlin Wall, was you can have German unification, but in return, we want a monetary union, and you give up the Deutschmark. Mm. Chancellor Kohl went along with that. The Bundesbank was against the central bank in Germany. There were always these fears that if you go for a European-wide monetary union, you can't trust the other Europeans to follow the same responsible, prudent path. So now, today, we're seeing that some of the tensions in what was a very delicate deal on monetary union, which was, okay, we'll go for it, but we want to have a German-style central bank with keeping fiscal discipline and other arrangements like a German style. But at the same time, you've got a membership which is not in tune with that political culture and economic culture and is now facing a crisis.
Simon, here's an email from Ken in Alexandria, who says, is it true Goldman Sachs was the architect behind Greece's debt plan? If so, this seems another example of Goldman Sachs being the global enabler of dubious financial schemes that ultimately enrich only Goldman Sachs and impoverish the rest of us. I'm really having a hard time seeing how the world would be any worse off if Goldman Sachs were to disappear.
I think the question is well articulated, and I don't think we would particularly suffer if our largest banks were made smaller. I don't think this is just about Goldman Sachs. I think there's a pattern of behavior. Goldman Sachs is obviously a lightning rod here and a pretty appealing one. And the fact they've said essentially nothing on the record about any of this and over the past 6 days or so is, of course, being taken as a further point against them. But it's other banks, too. And it's a pattern of behavior among these largest banks. And it's very much about the structure of the over-the-counter derivatives market. So it's a broader systemic and political issue, I would emphasize. And if I could just go back to a point that I think Lionel was making a moment ago, the deal was that exactly as he and Sebastian said, that you'd run this low inflation Germanic type of system. It turns out that's not a good system for these countries in Southern Europe. They've really struggled in this low inflation regime. The Germans have a tight grip on the European Central Bank. It's actually going to get tighter as a result of this crisis, because the number two candidate, there are two candidates to take over the European Central Bank now. One is a German, the other is an Italian. The Italian, turns out, ran part of Goldman Sachs during this whole let's disguise the debt phase. So I think he's totally out of the running. The Germans are going to have complete control of the European Central Bank going forward. This is going to be a long, hard slog for those other economies.
I think you're impugning the current governor of the Bank of Italy, Simon. That's a little unfair. Some of these transactions when he was not in that position at Goldman Sachs. I mean, I think we need to be a little bit careful about that. And we also need to avoid seeing the world purely through the prism of Goldman. I mean, there are other institutions, we've mentioned some, including European financial institutions like UBS, that basically almost blew itself up through irresponsible lending. So
but
it's not just the not
Sebastian,
just
what about the IMF and whether the IMF might step in to assist Greece. Isn't there some political rivalry going on there?
Well, that's right. I mean, the head of the IMF right now is Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who turns out to be a presidential contender in France. And so
against Sarkozy,
and so Sarkozy would like to keep Strauss-Kahn out of this European theatre to prevent his rival getting a good sort of public relations, spotlight. So that's a sort of silly, complicating thing in bringing the IMF in. There's also more serious stuff about the Europeans simply finding it unthinkable that they would be embarrassed to the extent of relying on the IMF. But I think actually most outside observers would say it would make tremendous sense to bring the IMF in, because you can't effectively have the Germans ordering the Greeks to raise the retirement age. I mean, that is politically toxic. The Greeks are not going to stand for that. The IMF can afford to be unpopular. That's what it's good at. It can impose the conditions that you need to impose with any kind of bailout, and it can take the heat.
I think this is an extraordinarily important point. The degree of resistance, and it's not just amongst politicians, it's also amongst the central banks. For example, Jean-Claude Trichet, the president of the European Central Bank, I'm told reliably, is absolutely against the IMF coming in. They would see this as somehow a failure of the monetary union, a failure of the European project, that somehow the external discipline would have to come from Washington through the IMF, even though, by the way, this is not an American institution. The Europeans are very well represented. And also there is the expertise in the IMF. I worry personally a great deal about German-imposed conditions, which are so severe if it comes to
like
it.
Like what?
That, well, it cuts your budget deficit by 8% inside 15 months. These kind of decisions, Sebastian referred to raising the pension age, real cuts in public sector workers' pay, as you're seeing in Ireland. If you're imposing those conditions, I mean, who knows what the political consequences could be in Greece?
But what kinds of actions does Greece have to take now to prove to the world that it's acting on this, Simon?
Well, the Greeks have to cut their budget deficit, I'm afraid. Now, this is precipitate fiscal austerity. It's not generally a good idea. If this spreads throughout the European Union or the Eurozone, it will slow down the world substantially. But as we talked about earlier, their budget deficit is much bigger than previously expected or understood. They have a substantial amount of debt. They have a lot of debt they need to roll over. If there were a generous outside financial package of the kind that the IMF might be able to put together, that would slow down this adjustment. That would be very helpful and constructive. But as Lana was saying just now, the Germans and the European Central Bank, which is very Germanic, are very much opposed to this, in part, I would add, because they don't want the IMF to come in and start to criticize the Eurozone for running overly restrictive policies. And they don't want the IMF to say, for example, that the Germans should run a looser fiscal policy. I mean, it's all very well to be tight and to be tough on the fiscal side, but if you're as tight as the Germans are, and if you push this low inflation, you are making it very hard to run a Eurozone. Now, they don't want the IMF to come in at that political level either.
You know, Diane, on your question, I mean, two or three days ago, I think the Greek finance minister himself said, turning the Greek economy around is like turning the Titanic around. When a country's finance minister compares his own economy to the Titanic, I think it's a fair bet that it will hit an iceberg and it will sink.
All right. So what happens here in the U.S. as we see the dollar on the rise against the euro? What does that mean for our economy in this country? Sebastian.
Well, weaker exports. I mean, a strong dollar is not good for the desire to get unemployment down from almost 10%, which is where it is now. It's a huge political issue, obviously, for President Obama. And he's not being helped by turmoil in Europe that is going to make for a stronger dollar, weaker demand in Europe, weaker exports to Europe. It's going to retard the whole project of recovery.
And Lionel, what about Europe's economic recovery?
Well, it's faltering badly. The question which we haven't really addressed enough is, where is the growth going to come from? And the fact is, under this, in this monetary union, Germany is not generating enough domestic demand to allow its neighboring countries to grow. Germany is remaining an exporter, and there needs to be a rebalancing of the Eurozone in the same way that we often talk about a rebalancing between America and China in the world economy.
So how do you see pressure being put on Germany to behave in a way that's conducive to the growth of the entire economic union.
I think that the pressure on the German government is extraordinary at the moment, both from outside, but particularly inside, with public opinion not being supportive of a Greek bailout. And they're not doing enough to generate domestic demand.
Okay, let's take this to the extreme. I have heard some extremely conservative radio commentators say this is the end of the euro. Is that how you see it, Sebastian?
I don't see it that way. I mean, I think, first of all, the thing to understand is if it was the end of the euro, it wouldn't simply be because of this budget crisis in Greece. It would be because Greece has lost competitiveness as an economy. And as I said earlier, their current account deficit is astronomically big, four times bigger as a percentage of GDP than the US one, which is itself very big. And so they are simply uncompetitive. And the normal way to get out of that is to have your currency fall and restore your competitiveness. If you're in a currency union, you can't do that. So the exit is closed. That would be the reason why you would exit.
Sebastian Malaby, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We have many callers. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Sycamore, Illinois. Good morning, Bob. You're on the air.
Yes, I believe that what we're witnessing is not by accident, by design, that the WTO with the GATT and NAFTA agreements is designed to lower the Western world's living standard, because that's easier than raising third world standards, and that they want a cheap labor force so that the elitists, you know, the multinational corporations, the international bankers, can reap massive profits on a cheap labor market. And this is by design. It is not an accident what we're witnessing.
Simon Johnson.
I don't think that these institutional arrangements are designed or intended to impoverish people. On the contrary. But the caller is right that the way that some of this is playing out, particularly the way in which the financial sector in the United States and in many other industrialized countries has become so big and so dangerous, it does have these very unfortunate, you could call it side effects, or you can say it's a main effect. We've lost 8 million jobs since December 2007 because of reckless risk-taking in the financial sector, and we're not fixing that problem. That is an integral part of the international institutional arrangements in the international fabric, and what we're seeing in Greece right now is just one additional manifestation of the way in which our financial and fiscal systems have gotten out of control.
You know, I think it's worth pointing out for the caller that the countries that are growing the fastest are the emerging economies right now. It's the Brazils, the Chinas, the Asians generally. And so, in fact, the poorer countries are doing the best. So that is not consistent with the idea that this is about impoverishing poor people. I think there is an issue in the global architecture. It's not the WTO, which has actually functioned incredibly well in the last 2 years, holding off a protectionist backlash, which we might well have seen in the downturn. So the WTO has been fantastic in preventing a return to the 1930s. But the thing we've got to think about is that there is no equivalent set of rules governing international capital flows. Trade flows, we understand, and we have rules. Capital flows is a bit of a zoo, and we see a lot of negative spillovers from that.
All right, to Sheila in DePoister, New York. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering, are the European countries as dependent on consumer spending as we are here? I mean, it seems like the consumers have to hold up our economy, and if we stop spending, everything falls apart. Is that part of their problem?
Lionel?
Not to the same degree as in the United States.
How come?
They make things. They like to export, particularly if you happen to be in Northern Europe. They're less governed. The service sector plays a less important role, apart from the United Kingdom.
Interesting. All right, to Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Angie.
Good morning, Diane. My question is mostly concerning the hypocrisy of what's going on in the governments and international monetary systems. I understand that hyping and crashing game that is going on all over the world. But the thing is, at least for Europe, this is a conglomerate of social democratic nations. But, however, in the United States, what I don't understand is the fact that this is a capitalist country, handing over billions of dollars to private companies when it is impossible. I mean, now we are at a standstill where we cannot pass a bill for public option health care for all Americans. It's really deplorable. What is that? How do you explain that?
Well, I think listening to you, one thing that strikes me is you're correct in saying that you have social democratic countries in Europe getting into trouble. At the same time, you have a lot of questions about the fiscal position in the U.S., a more liberal capitalist system. And the thought that triggers in my mind is going back to something that Simon Johnson said earlier. You can have Goldman Sachs marketing fancy swaps and securitizations and getting countries' budgets into trouble, but you can also have a U.S.-style mess where we simply have entitlements that we're not willing to put aside money for, and we're going to get into an equivalent, perhaps, fiscal train wreck down the road without any fancy derivatives. So all kinds of systems can mess up in their own very special ways.
Sebastian Mallaby, we'll take just a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the role of currency speculators. Take your calls, comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org, by Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international coverage and its foreign correspondents, and by PBS, presenting The National Parks, America's Best Idea, from filmmaker Ken Burns, airing tonight at 9, 8 Central on PBS. This is NPR.
Life After Loss, essayist and PBS NewsHour commentator Roger Rosenblatt recounts the struggle to help his son and on three young grandchildren cope with the sudden death of his 38-year-old daughter. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And here's an email from Frank at Indiana University, who says, yes, the Greek government has been profligate. My concern is that we're taking an entirely ahistorical view of the crisis. When Greece entered the currency union, they were forced to submit to an economic and trade regime designed by, major EU countries to benefit their economics. Limits were placed on Greek exports, and no real thought was given to how the Greek economy was going to remain in the black. Additionally, Germany, with its severe austerity measures, has actually deflated wages over the past decade, reducing money spent on tourism. This is an EU crisis, not simply a Greek crisis. Simon.
Well, it is certainly an EU crisis, and I think ultimately there will be a bailout for Greece, because not particularly the Germans feeling sorry for the Greeks. I think that, though, it's much more about how it can spread. Portugal, definitely in the line of fire. There are a lot of concerns about Spain. You might think that the Spanish banks can withstand anything that comes at them, or you might not. And then, of course, there's issues that people raise about Italy, which I personally think are somewhat exaggerated. So I think in this deal that Greece voluntarily entered into, you can certainly see both sides of it, and you can certainly see why there's some complaints from the Greek side. But I think ultimately the Germans will have to swallow their pride, and it's very annoying to provide these subsidies. But they did also sign up for this, and they have also, I think, brought some of this on everybody by really insisting on this very low inflation policy. Right.
Well, let's not rewrite history here. Greece has been the recipient of billions and billions of euros, dollars worth of support, regional aid from the European Union, which largely financed by Germany. Greece has also benefited by being part of a single market where money can be transferred easily, financial transfers, capital flows, trade. Greece has also, remember, joined the Democracy of Nations in the last 30 years. It's part of a political community. So, Greece has been a net beneficiary of being a member of the European Union, not a victim.
So what are the Greek people themselves feeling about what they read, what they see happening, what they anticipate, Lionel? Well,
a level of cynicism towards their political leaders, which is hard for even a hard-bitten Brit like myself to estimate. I mean, they really feel let down. They also feel that they have been cast adrift by the European Union at the moment. They know that they face very severe austerity measures. They're looking at 10 years of declining, possibly declining living standards. So this is all very, very difficult for them. And there are street protests. Simon referred to the fact that taxpayers are on strike. There are quite a few other people on strike too.
Here's one emailer. Are the European countries better off breaking up the European Union into separate countries or continuing the way they are? Sebastian.
I think one should put that question to the Thais, who remember 1997 and their crisis. When you've got a crisis, the last thing you do is you throw your stabilizing institutions out of the window. If you do not have a common currency and you have a crisis, then not only do you have a debt default and maybe a banking crisis, but you also have a collapsing currency, which kind of compounds the problem. To exit the euro right now for Greece would be to rewrite all the contracts that exist in the country, to give up the whole anchor of stability that you had, and it would just make no sense, I think.
All right, to Heartland, Michigan. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning. My question is, my wife and I are taking a 3-week honeymoon in Greece starting about the middle of May through the beginning of June, and I'm wondering how our travel experience might be impacted by the economical difficulties the country is facing right now.
Well, there have been a lot of strikes all over Greece. It's interesting from an economic standpoint that the tax collectors are on strike and they're not collecting taxes, that the statisticians in the finance ministry are supposed to be measuring this problem are on strike, they're not measuring it. But from your point of view, you care about the fact that the taxi drivers are on strike today. They've gone on strike again last week. Transport in general is going to be difficult, so you might be in for some frustrations.
What else, Lionel?
Well, on the other hand, the Greek economy needs all the help it can get, and if you're willing to spend some dollars there, that'll be really helpful.
Well, what about you, Simon? What do you think?
I think it will be a fascinating thing to observe. I can't imagine a more interesting economic episode to see on one's honeymoon.
All right, Josh. Good luck to you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right, to Durham, New Hampshire, and to Tom. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. It seems to me that what we're really seeing here are regional symptoms of a huge global recession. And I'd like just to refer back to a report, 60 Minutes, close to 2 years, in which Steve Cross asked a question of how credit default swaps, and this was the first time I'd ever heard that term, how credit default swaps were invested in worldwide, a number of the amount of the money. And it was $60 trillion worldwide. So I think what we see are more and more symptoms of a problem that really hasn't completely unraveled yet. And I'd like to hear what your panel has to say. Thank you.
Simon.
Yes, that's the those numbers, the trillions in the tens of trillions or 60 or 70 trillions are the notional values of those derivatives. That's the amount that's insured. It's not the actual amount of money that people can lose. The amount of money people can lose is enough to bring down your financial system. You saw that with AIG. And I think, Tom is right that we're seeing a global recession. And as you remarked at the beginning, Diane, when you have a big, massive turndown at the global level, you find out who has got what kinds of weaknesses, what kinds of problems. And that is what has brought the Greek vulnerability to the fore. That is what continues to push all of our banking systems in very tough and difficult ways. So I think that this is a broader pattern.
This is, the caller's right, part of the continuing recession that began 2 or 3 years ago. But it's also an important pivot. And the pivot is that in the first part, in 2008, 2009, we got used to thinking of the government as the savior, the rescuer. It rides in and it bails out banks, it bails out economies by pumping demand in. Central banks innovated all these different ways of helping all corners of the financial markets to carry on breathing. And that's why we haven't descended into the 1930s, because governments really did act and rescue. But now, governments are becoming the source of the trouble. It's a sovereign crisis now, and so we're into a new phase.
Lion. I just want to say a word about credit default swaps, which are, in effect, sophisticated insurance against debt defaults. There is a problem in the sense that some of the investment banks, all the investment banks, sold these through AIG, whatever, around the world. But on the other side of the equation, other parts, traders in those banks were betting in favor of a default. So they've been on both sides, and they made a lot of money about this. And there was a very, very interesting article last week in the Financial Times about exactly this question, identifying how it works and some of the problems. And it was called Joining the Greek Pinata Party.
Here's the final issue that everybody needs to understand. What can or should the Obama administration be doing about all this, Sebastian?
Well, I don't think it's a good idea for the United States, and especially not for somebody like President Obama, who has made himself, he's sort of defined himself as the anti-George Bush in foreign policy, to sort of be seen to be, marching into Europe and pushing the door open and demanding that he has a role. I mean, this is fundamentally a European problem, and until the Europeans invite in the IMF, which I think they should do, you can't force them to do it. I think
Simon,
we have to wait.
Do you think they should invite in the IMF?
Yes, I do, actually. I think the IMF may come with some reluctance. Nobody wants to be burned in effigy in the streets of Athens. But I think it would be constructive, and I think it would give them a pressure point vis-a-vis the European Union and the French and the Germans. So the fact that the French, as Sebastian said, really don't want the IMF to come in is something that Greece should use to its advantage and to get better terms from the European Union.
The Obama administration should not be saying anything in public. There was a phrase which George Bush used to use at the end of the Cold War, where he said, don't gloat, referring to the Soviet Union's difficulties. And they also are not in a strong position to give any economic lectures right now, given the problems at home.
Lionel Barber of the Financial Times, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We'll go back to the phones to Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Good morning, Quincy. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Diane Rehm. I love your show, by the way.
Thank you so much.
Steve, we're talking, a lot of the experts are really talking about the government's responsibility on the crisis. But how about the people's responsibility on the crisis? The government really rely on the people, buying stuff, causing the economy to thrive. But the majority of people that I know, even the ones making $200,000 a year, $100,000 a year, a lot of the people over leverage themselves, where they're living paycheck to paycheck, or in the past few years ended up having some fancy strategies to pay their bills. And now, they cannot refinance and all that. So people are stuck with bills, they cannot pay, and they're not buying as much because they feel, they're not, they cannot balance their personal budgets. So it's not just, governments rely on the people, but once the people are weak, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I sure do. Lionel, what about the Greek people themselves? Are they in the same situation as those folks here in the United States, living paycheck to paycheck, barely being able to pay bills? What is their economic situation?
Well, it's tough, but it's actually not as tough, as in my view, as in so many places in the United States.
Really?
Right now. No, not at all. I mean, there has been a reasonable growth, particularly over the last 10 years since they've been in the Eurozone, but there is a period of austerity coming. It's going to be a grim few years. And the question is whether Greeks are prepared to take the kind of bold steps, huge steps, which the Irish have taken, where, for example, public sector teachers have taken 17% or so cut in real wages in order to make the adjustment that Sebastian was talking about to correct these imbalances in the economy, given the fact, we repeat, that in a monetary union, you can't use the traditional tool for an adjustment, which is a devaluation of the currency.
Here is
Diane. Could I?
Sure, go ahead, Simon.
So I think you can certainly blame to some extent the Greek people. You can also blame the foreign investors who bought the debt issued by the Greek government. But we come back again to the issue of misrepresentation. So who was lying and what were they lying about?
The Greek prime minister said to his fellow leaders, and I spoke to somebody who was in the room in December at the European summit, where he said he gave this dramatic speech in which he said, "We, the Greek government, were corrupt to the bone." To the bone. Those were his words. And he said, this is endemic. And it's not just our government. It's been around for a very long time. We're going to have to completely change. So I think that partly answers Simon's question.
Simon?
Yes, it partly answers my question. Unfortunately, there are other people who aided and abetted in this lying, and we need a full accounting. And I don't think Lionel Wood is opposing, or his newspaper is opposing, the investigation by Eurostat and the
We're
attempt
fully in
now.
Support of it.
Absolutely,
by what the is attempt that now by the European investigation Commission. As to exactly who was responsible?
Well, to look at how the falsification of statistics came about.
I mean, surely there were multiple layers of people watching what was happening, Sebastian.
Well, that's right. And that's why in 2004, for example, there was a marked policy shift by the Eurostat, the European Statistics Agency, where some of the securitizations that had been used to disguise debt or push it into the future were then disallowed. And so policies have changed, showing that the policymakers actually were thinking about this, and they were aware that people can push the envelope dangerously. So, again, I think to sort of put responsibility on the people who design the transactions is only part of the issue.
There is an op-ed piece in this morning's Washington Post suggesting that the United States is the next Greece. What was your reaction, Lionel?
I think there's a phrase that we use occasionally in Britain called poppycock. that was my response. The fact that the analogy completely breaks down between the United States and Greece. The United States has huge still reserves, strengthening its economy. And above all, the Americans have the ability to devalue. There is the currency adjustment, which is possible, which is not possible in the Eurozone.
That's right. Lionel's right. I mean, the U.S. has an independent currency, which can devalue. It has an independent monetary policy, so it can use the interest rate tool, whereas the Greeks have the European Central Bank. They don't have their own policy tools. But there is actually, I think, not too much room for complacency, because you can get into a dynamic where if global interest rates start to rise, because you do get a recovery, and if, importantly, the exporters of savings, which have been the emerging economies in the world, start to, in fact, consume more and export fewer savings, there'll be less capital, the cost of capital will go up, that means the interest rate goes up, and suddenly the enormous public debt in the U.S., which we've been able to service in terms of the interest payments on it, suddenly becomes a lot more expensive. It's important to remember that the debt structure of U.S. government debt is very short. In other words, it's all going to roll over quite quickly. Its sort of average time is sort of 5 years. The last time in history when U.S. government debt was on the scale that we see now was after the borrowing in the Second World War. And the difference in the late 1940s was that the average maturity of the U.S. government debt was sort of well over 10 years. It was very long-term debt, so you could afford to sort of put that problem off a bit. Now you have a lot of short-term debt. If interest rates suddenly rise, we may be finding ourselves in a bit of a tough
Simon,
position.
Simon, do you agree with Lionel's word, poppycock?
Yeah, that's a technical term. I may have forgotten what it means exactly. The point I would make, Diane, is that the problems in Europe undermine the euro. That pushes people towards buying dollars. That's where people like to park their money around the world, including central banks. That gives us time, gives us an opportunity to fix our own problems. But there's no question that over the medium term, we have to bring the U.S. fiscal deficit under control. And if we don't do that, there will be trouble.
Last word from Simon Johnson. We've also heard from Sebastian Malaby and Lionel Barber. How good to see you both. Thank you so much. And Simon, next time, I hope you'll come in.
Absolutely.
Thanks for being here all. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.